out and asked Monday if he was willing to chance the woman's embrace for a while. He said he was, and left the maestro to find himself a seat by the bird-breeding lake while he ventured into its maker's boudoir. It was the first time in Gentle's life that any woman in search of sexual attentions had passed him over for another. If ever he'd needed proof that his day was done, it was here. When, after 2 hours, Monday reappeared, with a flushed face and ringing ears, it was to find Gentle sitting at the lakeside, long ago tired of working on his map, surrounded by several small cairns of pebbles.
"What are these?" the boy said.
"I've been counting my romances," Gentle replied. "Each one of them is 100 women." There were 7 cairns.
"Is that them all?" Monday said.
"It's all that I remember." Monday squatted down beside the stones.
"I'll bet you'd like to love them all over again," he said.
Gentle thought about this for a little time and finally said, "No, I don't think so. I've done my best work. It's time to leave it to the younger men." He tossed the stone he had in hand out into the middle of the teeming lake. "Before you ask," he said, "that was Jude." There were no diversions after that, nor any need to pursue rumours of women hither and thither. They knew where Jude and Hoi Polloi had gone. Having left the lake, they were on the Lenten Way within a matter of hours. Unlike so much else, the way hadn't changed. It was as busy and as wide as ever, an arrow driving its straight way into the hot heart of Isordrex. Chapter 26. 1. In the 5th, winter came. Not suddenly, but certainly. Halloween was the last time people chanced the night air without coats, hats, and gloves, and it saw the first substantial visitation of Londoners to Gamut Street, revellers who'd taken the spirit of All Hallows' Eve to heart and come to see if there was any truth in the bizarre rumours they'd heard about the neighbourhood. Some retreated after a very short time, but the braver among them stayed to explore, a few lingering outside number 28, where they puzzled over the designs on the door and peered up at the carbonized tree that shaded the house from the stars. After that evening, the cold nip became a bite, and the bite a gnaw, until by late November the temperatures were low enough to keep even the most ardent tomcat at the fire. But the flow of visitors, in both directions, didn't cease. Night after night, ordinary citizens appeared in Gamut Street to brush shoulders with the excursionists who were coming in the opposite direction. Some of the former became such regular visitors that Clem began to recognize them and was able to watch their investigations grow less tentative as they realized that the sensations they felt were not the first signs of lunacy. There were wonders to be found here, and one by one these men and women must have discovered the source, because they invariably disappeared. Others, perhaps too afraid to venture into the passing places alone, came with trusted friends, showing them the street as though it were a secret vice, talking in whispers, then laughing out loud when they found their loved ones could see the apparitions too. Word was spreading, but that fact was the only pleasure those bitter days and nights provided. Though Tick Raw spent more and more time in the house and was lively company, Clem missed Gentle badly. He hadn't been altogether surprised at his abrupt departure. He'd known, even if Gentle hadn't, that sooner or later the maestro would leave the Dominion. But now his truest company was the man with whom he shared his skull, and as the first anniversary of Tay's death approached, the mood of both grew steadily darker. The presence of so many living souls on the street only served to make the revenants who'd occupied it through the summer months feel further disenfranchised, and their distress was contagious. Though Tay had been happy to stay with Clem through the preparations for the great work, their time as angels was over, and Tay felt the same need as those ghosts who roamed outside the house, to be gone. As December came, Clem began to wonder how many more weeks he could keep his post, when it seemed every hour the despair of the ghost in him grew. After much debate with himself, he decided that Christmas would mark the last day of his service in Gamut Street. After that, he'd leave number 28 to be tramped around by Tick's excursionists.
and go back to the house, where a year before he and Tay had celebrated the return of the unvanquished son.
2. Jude and Hoi Polloi had taken their time crossing the Dominions, but with so many roads to choose between, and so many incidental joys along the way, going quickly seemed almost criminal. They had no reason to hurry. There was nothing behind them to drive them on, and nothing in front summoning them. At least, so Jude pretended. Time and time again, when the issue of their ultimate destination cropped up in conversation, she avoided talking about the place she knew in her heart of hearts they would eventually reach. But if the name of that city wasn't on her lips, it was on the lips of almost every other woman they met, and when Hoi Polloi mentioned that it was her birthplace, questions from fellow travellers would invariably flow thick and fast. Was it true that the harbour was now filled at every tide with fish that had swum up from the depths of the ocean, ancient creatures that knew the secret of the origins of women and swam up the rivered streets at night to worship the goddesses on the hill? Was it true that the women there could have children without any need of men whatsoever, and that some could even dream babies into being? And were there fountains in that city that made the old young, and trees on which every fruit was new to the world? And so on, and so forth. And though Jude was willing, if pressed, to supply descriptions of what she'd seen in his Ordorex, her accounts of how the palace had been refashioned by water and of streams that defied gravity were not particularly remarkable in the face of what rumour was claiming about his Ordorex. After a few conversations in which she was urged to describe marvels she had no knowledge of, as though the questioners were willing her to invent prodigies rather than disappoint them, she told Hoi Polloi she'd not be drawn into any further debates on the subject. But her imagination refused to ignore the tales it heard, however preposterous, and with every mile they travelled along the Lenten Way, the idea of the city awaiting them at the end of their journey grew more intimidating. She fretted that perhaps the blessings bestowed on her there would be valueless after all the time she'd spent away from the place, or that the goddesses knew that she'd told Sartori, in all truth, that she loved him, and that Joko Leilau's condemnation of her would carry the day if she ever went back into their temple. Once they were on the Lenten Way, however, such fears became academic. They were not going to turn back now, especially as both of them were becoming steadily more exhausted. The city called them out of the fogs that lay between dominions, and they would go into it together and face whatever judgments, prodigies, and deep-sea fish were waiting there. Oh, but it was changed. A warmer season was on the second than when Jude had last been here, and with so much water running in the streets, the air was tropical. But more breathtaking than the humidity was the growth it had engendered. Seeds and spores had been carried up from the seams and caverns beneath the city in vast numbers, and under the influence of the goddess's fates had matured with preternatural speed. Ancient forms of vegetation, most long believed extinct, had greened the rubble, turning the Kesperates into luxuriant jungle. In the space of half a year, Isordorex had come to resemble a lost city, sacred to women and children, its desolation salved by flora. The smell of ripeness was everywhere, its source the fruits that glistened on vine and bough and bush, the abundance of which had in turn attracted animals that would never have dared Isordorex under its previous regime. And running through this cornucopia, feeding the seeds it had raised from the underworld, the eternal waters, still flowing up the hillsides in their riotous way, but no longer carrying their fleets of prayers. Either the requests of those who lived here had been answered, or else their baptisms had made them their own healers and restorers. Jude and Hoi Polloi didn't go up to the palace the day they arrived, nor the day after, nor the day after that. Instead, they searched for the Peckable House, and there made themselves comfortable, though the tulips on the dining room table had been replaced by a throng of blossoms that had erupted through the floor, and the roof had become an aviary. After so long a journey, in which they'd not known from night to night where they were going to lay their heads, these were minor inconveniences, and they were grateful to be at rest, lulled to sleep by cooings and chatterings in beds that were more like bowers. When they woke, there was plenty to eat, fruit that could be picked off the trees,
water that ran clear and cold in the street outside, and in some of the larger streams, fish, which formed the staple diet of the clans that lived in the vicinity. There were men as well as women among these extended families, some of whom must have been members of the mobs and armies that had run so brutally riot on the night the autarch fell. But either gratitude at having survived the revolution, or the calming influence of the growth and plenitude around them, had persuaded them to better purpose. Hands that had maimed and murdered were now employed rebuilding a few of the houses, raising their walls not in defiance of the jungle or the waters that fed it, but in league with both. This time the architects were women, who'd come down from their baptisms, inspired to use the wreckage of the old city to create a new one. And everywhere Jude saw echoes of the serene and elegant aesthetic that marked the goddess's handiwork. And there was no great sense of urgency attending these constructions, nor, she thought, any sign of a grand design being adhered to. The age of empire was over, and all dogmas, edicts, and conformities had gone with it. People solved the problems of putting a roof over their heads in their own way, knowing that the trees were both shady and bountiful in the meantime. The houses that resulted were as different as the faces of the women who supervised their construction. The Sartori she'd met in Gamut Street would have approved, Jude thought. Hadn't he touched her cheek during their penultimate encounter and told her he'd dreamed of a city built in her image? If that image was woman, then here was that city, rising from the ruins. So by day they had the murmuring canopy, the bubbling rivers, the heat, the laughter. And by night, slumbers beneath a feathered roof and dreams that were kind and uninterrupted. Such was the case, at least, for a week. But on the eighth night, Jude was woken by Hoi Polloi, who called her to the window.
Look!
She looked. The stars were bright above the city and ran silver in the river below, but there were other forms in the water, she realized, more solid but no less silver. The talk they'd heard on the road was true. Climbing the river were creatures that no fishing boat, however deep it trawled, would ever have found in its nets. Some had a trace of dolphin in them, or squid, or manta ray, but their common trait was a hint of humanity, buried as deep in their past, or future, as their homes were in ocean. There were limbs on some of them, and these few seemed to leap the slope rather than swim it. Others were as sinuous as eels, but had heads that carried a mammalian cast, their eyes luminous, their mouths fine enough to make words. The sight of their ascent was exhilarating, and Jude stayed at the window until the entire shoal had disappeared up the street. She had no doubt of their destination, nor indeed of her own after this.
"We're as rested as we're ever going to be," she said to Hoi Polloi. "So it's time to go up the hill?" "Yes. I think it is."
They left the Peckable House at dawn, in order to make much of the ascent before the comet climbed too high and the humidity sapped their strength. It had never been an easy journey, but even in the cool early morning, it became a back-breaking trudge, especially for Jude, who felt as though she were carrying a lead weight in her womb rather than a living soul. She had to call a halt to the climb several times and sit in the shade to catch her breath, but on the fourth such occasion, she rose to find her gasps becoming steadily shallower, and a pain in her belly so acute she could barely hold on to consciousness. Her agitation, and Hoi Polloi's yelps, drew helping hands, and she was being lowered onto a knoll of flowering grasses when her waters broke. A little less than an hour later, not more than half a mile from where the gate of the Twin Saints Crees and Evendown had stood, in a grove busy with tiny turquoise birds, she gave birth to the autarch Sartori's first and only child.
3. Though Jude and Hoi Polloi's pursuers had left the lake maker in the Quem with clear directions, they still reached Isordrex 6 weeks later than the women. This was in part because Monday's sexual appetite was significantly depleted after his liaison in the Quem Palace, and he set a far less hectic pace than he had hitherto, but more particularly because Gentle's enthusiasm for cartography grew by leaps and bounds.
Belianar would go by without his remembering some province he'd passed through, or some signpost he'd seen, and whenever he did so the journey was interrupted while he brought out his handmade album of charts and religiously set down the details, rattling off the names of uplands, lowlands, forests, plains, highways, and cities like a litany while he worked. He wouldn't be hurried, even if the chance of a ride was missed, or a good drenching gained in the process. This was, he told Monday, the true great work of his life, and he only regretted that he'd come to it so late. These interruptions notwithstanding, the city got closer day by day, mile by mile, until one morning, when they raised their heads from their pillars beneath a hawthorn bush, the mists cleared to show them a vast green mountain in the distance.
"What is that place?" Monday wondered.
Astonished, Gentle said, "Isorderex."
"Where's the palace? Where's the streets? All I can see is trees and rainbows."
Gentle was as confounded as the boy. "It used to be grey and black and bloody," he said.
"Well, it's fucking green now."
It got greener the closer they came, the scent of its vegetation so sweetening the air that Monday soon lost his scowl of disappointment and remarked that perhaps this wouldn't be so bad after all. If his Isorderex had turned into a wild wood, then maybe all the women had become savages, dressed in berry juice and smiles. He could suffer that a while. What they found on the lower slopes, of course, were scenes more extraordinary than Monday's most heated imaginings. So much of what the inhabitants of the new Isorderex took for granted, the anarchic waters, the primeval trees, left both man and boy agog. They gave up voicing their awe after a time and simply climbed through the lavish thicket, steadily sloughing off the weight of baggage they'd accrued on their journey and leaving it scattered in the grass. Gentle had intended to go to the Ur-Hotemic Kesperut in the hope of locating Athanasius, but with the city so transformed it was a slow and difficult trek, so it was more luck than wit that brought them, after an hour or more, to the gate. The streets beyond it were as overgrown as those they'd come through, the terraces resembling some orchard that had been left to riot, its fallen fruit the rubble that lay between the trees. At Monday's suggestion, they split up to search for the maestro, Gentle telling the boy that if he saw Jesus somewhere in the trees, then he'd discovered Athanasius. But they both came back to the gate, having failed to find him, obliging Gentle to ask some children who'd come to play swinging games on the gate if any of them had seen the man who'd lived here. One of the number, a girl of 6 or so, with her hair so plaited with vines she looked as though she was sprouting them, had an answer.
"He went away," she said.
"Do you know where?"
"Nope,"
she said again, speaking on behalf of her little tribe. "Does anybody know?"
"Nope."
Which exchange brought the subject of Athanasius to a swift halt.
"Where now?"
Monday asked, as the children returned to their games. "We follow the water," Gentle replied. They began to ascend again, while the comet, which had long since passed its zenith, made the contrary motion. They were both weary now, and the temptation to lie down in some tranquil spot grew with every stride they took. But Gentle insisted they go on, reminding Monday that Hoi Polloi's bosom would be a far more comfortable place to lay his head than any hummock, and her kisses more invigorating than a dip in any pool. His talk was persuasive, and the boy found an energy Gentle envied, bounding on to clear the way for the maestro until they reached the mounds of dark rubble that marked the walls of the palace. Rising from them, the columns from which had once hung an enormous pair of gates were turned to playthings by the waters, which climbed the right pillar in rivulets, and threw themselves across the gap in a drizzling arch that squarely struck the top of the left. It was a most beguiling spectacle, and one that claimed Gentle's attention completely, leaving Monday to head between the columns alone. After a short time, his shout came back to fetch Gentle, and it was blissful.
"Boss? Boss! Come here!"
Gentle followed where Monday's cries led, through the warm rain beneath the arch and into the palace itself. He found Monday wading across a courtyard, fragrant with the lilies that trembled on its flood, towards a figure standing beneath the colonnade on the other side. It was Hoi Polloi. Her hair was plastered to her scalp as though she'd just swum the pool, and the bosom upon which Monday was so eager to lay his head was bare.
"So you're here at last," she said, looking past Monday towards Gentle.
Her eager beau lost his footing halfway across, and lilies flew as he hauled himself to his feet.
"You knew we were coming,"
he said to the girl.
"Of course," she replied. "Not you, but the maestro. We knew the maestro was coming." "But it's me you're glad to see, right?"
Monday spluttered.
"I mean, you are glad?"
She opened her arms to him.
"What do you think?"
she said. He whooped his whoop and splashed on towards her, peeling off his soaked shirt as he went. Gentle followed in his wake. By the time he reached the other side, Monday was stripped down to his underwear.
"How did you know we were coming here?"
Gentle asked the girl.
"There are prophetics everywhere," she said. "Come on, I'll take you up." "Can't he go on his own?"
Monday protested.
"We'll have plenty of time later,"
Hoi Polloi said, taking his hand.
"But first I have to take him up to the chambers."
The trees within the ring of the demolished walls dwarfed those outside, inspired to unprecedented growth by the almost palpable sanctity of this place. There were women and children in their branches and among their gargantuan roots, but Gentle saw no men here, and supposed that if Hoi Polloi hadn't been escorting them, they'd have been asked to leave. How such a request would have been enforced, he could only guess, but he didn't doubt that the presences which charged the air and earth here had their ways. He knew what those presences were, the promised goddesses, whose existence he'd first heard mooted in Beatrix, while sitting in Mother Splendid's kitchen. The journey was circuitous. There were several places where the rivers ran too hard and deep to be forded, and Hoi Polloi had to lead them to bridges or stepping stones, then double back along the opposite bank to pick up the track again. But the farther they went, the more sentient the air became. And though Gentle had countless questions to ask, he kept them to himself rather than display his naivety. There were tidbits from Hoi Polloi once in a while, so casually dropped they were enigmas in themselves.
"The fires are so comical," she said at one point,
as they passed a pile of twisted metalwork that had been one of the Autark's war machines, and at another place where a deep blue pool housed fish the size of men said,
"Apparently they have their own city, but it's so deep in the ocean I don't suppose I'll ever see it. The children will, though. That's what's wonderful."
Finally she brought them to a door that was curtained with running water and, turning to Gentle, said,
"They're waiting for you."
Monday went to step through the curtain at Gentle's side, but Hoi Polloi restrained him with a kiss on his neck.
"This is just for the maestro," she said. "Come along. We'll go swimming." "Boss?"
"Go ahead," Gentle told him. "No harm's going to come to me here."
"I'll see you later, then,"
Monday said, content to have Hoi Polloi tug him away. Before they'd disappeared into the thicket, Gentle turned to the door, dividing the cool curtain with his fingers and stepping into the chamber beyond. After the riot of life outside, both its scale and its austerity came as a shock. It was the first structure he'd seen in the city that preserved something of his brother's lunatic ambition. Its vastness was uninvaded by all but a few shoots and tendrils, and the only waters that ran here were at the door behind him and those falling from an arch at the other end. The goddesses had not left the chamber entirely unmarked, however. The walls of what had been built as a windowless hall were now pierced on all sides, so that for all its immensity the place was a honeycomb, penetrated by the soft light of evening. There was only one item of furniture, a chair close to the distant arch, and seated upon it, with a baby on her lap, was Judith. As Gentle entered, she looked up from the child's face and smiled at him.
"I was beginning to think you'd lost your way," she said.
Her voice was light, almost literally, he thought. When she spoke, the beams that came through the walls flickered.
"I didn't know you were waiting," he said.
"It's been no great hardship," she said. "Won't you come closer?"
As he crossed the chamber towards her, she said,
"I didn't expect you to follow us at first, but then I thought, he will, he will."
because he'll want to see the child.
To be honest, I didn't think about the child.
Well, she thought about you,
Jude said, without rebuke. The baby in her lap could not be more than a few weeks old, but, like the trees and flowers here, was burgeoning. She sat on Jude's lap rather than lay, one small, strong hand clutching her mother's long hair. Though Jude's breasts were bare and comfortable, the child had no interest in nourishment or sleep. Her grey eyes were fixed on Gentle, studying him with an intense and quizzical stare.
"How's Clem?"
Jude asked when Gentle stood before her.
"He was fine when I last saw him. But I left rather suddenly, as you know. I feel rather guilty about that. But once I'd started..."
"I know. There was no turning back. It was the same for me."
Gentle went down on his haunches in front of Jude and offered his hand, palm up, to the child. She grasped it instantly.
"What's her name?"
he said.
"I hope you won't mind."
"What?"
"I called her Huzzah."
Gentle smiled up at Jude.
"You did?"
Then back to the baby, called by her scrutiny.
"Huzzah?"
he said, leaning his face towards hers.
"Huzzah, I'm Gentle."
"She knows who you are,"
Jude said, without a trace of doubt.
"She knew about this room before it even existed, and she knew you'd come here sooner or later."
Gentle didn't inquire as to how the child had shared her knowledge. It was just one more mystery to add to the catalogue in this extraordinary place.
"And the goddesses?" he said.
"What about them?"
"They don't mind that she's Sartori's child."
"Not at all,"
Jude said, her voice daintier at the mention of Sartori.
"The whole city. The whole city's here to prove how good can come from bad."
"She's better than good, Jude," Gentle said.
She smiled, and so did the child.
"Yes, she is."
Huzzah was reaching for Gentle's face, ready to topple from Jude's lap in pursuit of her object.
"I think she sees her father,"
Jude said, lifting the child back into the crook of her arm and standing up. Gentle also stood, watching Jude carry Huzzah to a litter of playthings on the ground. The child pointed and gurgled.
"Do you miss him?" he said.
"I did in the fifth,"
Jude replied, her back still turned, while she picked up Huzzah's chosen toy.
"But I don't hear. Not since Huzzah. I never felt quite real till she appeared. I was a figment of the other Judith."
She stood up again, turning to Gentle.
"You know, I still can't really remember all those missing years. I get snatches of them once in a while, but nothing solid. I suppose I was living in a dream. But she's woken me, Gentle."
Jude kissed the baby's cheek.
"She's made me real. I was only a copy until her. We both were. He knew it, and I knew it. But we made something new."
She sighed.
"I don't miss him," she said. "But I wish he could have seen her. Just once. Just so he could have known what it was to be real, too."
She started to cross back to the chair, but the child reached out for Gentle again, letting out a little cry to emphasize her wishes.
"My, my," Jude said, "you are popular."
She sat down again and put the toy she'd picked up in front of Huzzah. It was a small blue stone.
"Here, darling,"
she cooed.
"Look, what's this? What's this?"
Gurgling with pleasure, the child claimed the plaything from her mother's finger with a dexterity far beyond her tender age. The gurgles became chuckles as she laid it to her lips as if to kiss it.
"She likes to laugh," Gentle said.
"She does, thank God. Oh, now listen to me. Still thanking God."
"Old habits."
"That one'll die,"
Jude said firmly. The child was putting the toy to her mouth.
"No, sweetie, don't do that,"
Jude said. Then, to Gentle,
"Do you think the erasure'll decay eventually? I have a friend here called Lottie. She says it will. It'll decay, and then we'll have to live with a stench from the first every time the wind comes that way."
"Maybe a wall could be built."
"By whom? Nobody wants to go near the place.
Not even the goddesses?
They've got their work here, and in the fifth. They want to free the waters there, too.
That should be quite a sight.
Yes, it should. Maybe I'll go back for that.
Huzar's laughter had subsided during this exchange, and she was once again studying Gentle, reaching up towards him from her mother's lap. This time her tiny hand was not open, but clutching the blue stone.
I think she wants you to have it, Jude said.
He smiled at the child and said,
Thank you, but you should keep it.
Her gaze became more intent at this, and he was certain she understood every word he was saying. Her hand still proffered its gift, determined he should take it.
Go on,
Jude said. As much at the behest of the eyes as at Jude's words, Gentle reached down and gingerly took the stone from Hosar's hand. There was some considerable strength in her. The stone was heavy, heavy and cool.
Now our peace is really made, Jude said.
I didn't know we'd been at war, Gentle replied.
That's the worst kind, isn't it? Jude said. But it's over now. It's over forever.
There was a subtle modulation in the plush of the water-curtained arch behind her, and she glanced around. Her expression had been grave, but when she looked back at Gentle, she had a smile on her face.
I have to go, she said as she stood.
The child was chuckling and clutching the air.
Will I see you again? Gentle said.
Jude shook her head slowly, looking at him almost indulgently.
What for? She murmured. We've said all we have to say. We've forgiven each other. It's finished.
Will I be allowed to stay in the city?
Of course, she said with a little laugh. But why would you want to?
Because I've come to the end of the pilgrimage.
Have you?
She said, turning from him to pad towards the arch.
I thought you had one dominion left.
I've seen it. I know what's there.
There was a pause. Then Jude said,
Did Celestine ever tell you her story? She did, didn't she?
The one about Nisi Nirvana?
Yes. She told it to me, too, the night before the reconciliation. Did you understand it?
Not really.
Ah.
Why?
It's just that I didn't either. And I thought maybe...
She shrugged.
I don't know what I thought.
She was at the archway now, and the child was peering over her shoulder at somebody who'd appeared behind the veil of water. The visitor was not, Gentle thought, quite human.
Hoi Polloi mentioned our other guests, did she?
Jude said, seeing his astonishment.
They came up out of the ocean to woo us.
She smiled.
Beautiful, some of them. There's going to be such children.
The smile faltered, just a little.
Don't be sad, Gentle, she said. We had our time.
Then she turned from him and took the child through the curtain. He heard Hosar laugh to see the face that awaited them on the other side, and saw its owner put his silvery arms around mother and child. Then the light in his eyes brightened, running in the curtain, and when it dimmed, the family had gone. Gentle waited in the empty chamber for several minutes, knowing Jude wasn't going to come back, not even certain that he wanted her to, but unable to depart until he had fixed in his memory all that had passed between them. Only then did he return to the door and step out into the evening air. There was a different kind of enchantment in the wild wood now. Soft blue mists drooped from the canopy and crept up from the pools. The mellifluous songs of dusk birds had replaced those of noon, and the busy drone of pollinators had given way to breath-wing moths. He looked for Monday but failed to find him, and although there was nobody to prevent his loitering in this idyll, he felt ill at ease. This was not his place now. By day it was too full of life, and by night, he guessed, too full of love. It was a new experience for him to feel so utterly immaterial. Even on the road, hanging back from the fires while nonsense tales were told, he'd always known that if he'd simply opened his mouth and identified himself, he would have been feted, encircled,
adored. Not so here. Here he was nothing. Nothing and nobody. There were new growths, new mysteries, new marriages. Perhaps his feet understood that better than his head, because before he'd properly confessed his redundancy to himself, they were already carrying him away, out under the water-clad arches and down the slope of the city. He didn't head towards the delta, but towards the desert, and though he'd not seen the purpose in this journey when Jude had hinted at it, he didn't now deny his feet their passage. When he'd last emerged from the gate that led out into the desert, he'd been carrying Pi, and there'd been a throng of refugees around them. Now he was alone, and though he had no other weight to carry besides his own, he knew the trek ahead of him would exhaust what little sum of will was left to him. He wasn't much concerned at this. If he perished on the way, it scarcely mattered. Whatever Jude had said, his pilgrimage was at an end. As he reached the crossroads where he'd encountered Flockus Dado, he heard a shout behind him and turned to see a bare-chested Monday galloping towards him through the dwindling light, mounted on a mule, or a striped variation thereof.
"What were you doing, going without me?"
he demanded, when he reached Gentle's side.
"I looked for you, but you weren't around. I thought you'd gone off to start a family with Hoi Polloi."
"Nah," said Monday. "She's got funny ideas, that girl. She said she wanted to introduce me to some fish. I said I wasn't too keen on fish because the bones get stuck in your throat. Well, that's right, isn't it? People choke on fish regular. Anyhow, she looks at me like I just farted and says maybe I should go with you after all. And I said, I didn't even know you was leaving. So she finds me this ugly little fuck," he slapped the hybrid's flank, "and points me in this direction."
He glanced back at the city.
"I think we're well out of there," he said, dropping his voice. "There was too much water, if you ask me. Do you see it at the gate? A great fucking fountain."
"No, I didn't. That must be recent."
"See? The whole place is going to drown. Let's get the fuck out of here. Hop on."
"What's the beast called?"
"Tolland,"
Monday said with a grin.
"Which way are we headed?"
Gentle pointed towards the horizon.
"I don't see nothing."
"Then that must be the right direction."
4. Ever the pragmatist, Monday hadn't left the city without supplies. He'd made a sack of his shirt and filled it to bursting with succulent fruits, and it was these that sustained them as they travelled. They didn't halt when night came, but kept up their steady pace, taking turns to walk beside the beast so as not to exhaust it, and giving it at least as much of the fruit as they ate themselves, plus the pith's, cores, and skins of their own portions. Monday slept much of the time that he rode, but Gentle, despite his fatigue, remained wide awake, too vexed by the problem of how he was going to set this wasteland down in his book of maps to indulge himself in slumber. The stone Huzzar had given him was constantly in his hand, coaxing so much sweat from his paws that several times a little pool gathered in the cup of his palm. Discovering this, he would put the stone away, only to find a few minutes later that he'd taken it out of his pocket without even realizing that he'd done so, and his fingers were once again making play with it. Now and then he'd cast a backward glance towards Isordorex, and it made quite a sight, the benighted flanks of the city glittering in countless places, as though the waters in its streets had become perfect mirrors for the stars. Nor was Isordorex the only source of such splendour. The land between the gates of the city and the track that they were following also gleamed here and there, catching its own fragments of the sky's display. But all such enchantments were gone by the first sign of dawn. The city had long since disappeared into the distance behind them, and the thunderheads in front were lowering. Gentle recognized the baleful colour of this sky from the glimpse he and Tick Raw had snatched of the first. Though the erasure still sealed Hepexamendios's pestilence from the second, its taint was too persuasive to be obliterated, and the bruisy heavens loomed vaster as they travelled, lying along the entire horizon and climbing to their zenith. There was some good news, however. They weren't alone. As the wretched remains of the Dirthers' tents appeared on the horizon, so too did a congregation of God-spotters, 30 or so, watching the erasure. One of them saw Gentle and Monday approaching, and word of their arrival passed through the small crowd until it reached one who instantly pelted in the traveller's direction.
"Maestro! Maestro!"
he yelled as he came. It was Chica Jackeen, of course, and he was in a fair ecstasy to see Gentle, though after the initial flood of greetings the talk became grim.
"What did we do wrong, Maestro?" he wanted to know. "This isn't the way it was meant to be, is it?"
Gentle did his weary best to explain, astonishing and appalling Chica Jackeen by turns.
"So Apexamendios is dead?"
"Yes, he is. And everything in the first is his body, and it's rotting to high heaven."
"What happens when the erasure decays?"
"Who knows? I'm afraid there's enough rot to stink out the Dominion."
"So what's your plan?" Chica Jackeen wanted to know.
"I don't have one." The other looked confounded at this.
"But you came all the way here," he said. "You must have had some notion or other."
"I'm sorry to disappoint you," Gentle replied, "but the truth is, this was the only place left for me to go." He stared at the erasure. "Apexamendios was my father, Lucius. Perhaps in my heart of hearts I believe I should be in the first with him."
"If you don't mind me saying so, boss," Monday broke in.
"Yes?"
"That's a bloody stupid idea."
"If you're going to go in, so am I," Chica Jackeen said. "I want to see for myself. A dead god's something to tell your children about, eh?"
"Children?"
"Well," said Jackeen, "it's either that or write my memoirs. I haven't got the patience for that."
"You?"
Gentle said. "You waited 200 years for me, and you say you haven't got patience?"
"Not any more," came the reply. "I want a life, Maestro."
"I don't blame you,
but not before I've seen the first."
They'd reached the erasure by now, and while Chica Jackeen went among his colleagues to tell them what he and the Reconciler were going to do, Monday once again piped up with his opinion on the venture.
"Don't do it, boss," he said. "You've got nothing to prove. I know you were pissed off that they didn't throw a party in his orderex, but fuck 'em, I say. Or rather, don't. Let 'em have their fish."
Gentle laid his hands on Monday's shoulders.
"Don't worry," he said. "This isn't a suicide mission."
"So what's the big hurry? You're dead beat, boss. Have a sleep. Eat something. Get strong. There's all of tomorrow not touched yet."
"I'm fine," Gentle said. "I've got my talisman."
"What's that?"
Gentle opened his palm and showed Monday the blue stone.
"A fucking egg?"
"An egg, eh?"
Gentle said, tossing the stone in his hand.
"Maybe it is."
He threw it up into the air a second time, and it rose, far higher than his muscle had propelled it, way up above their heads. At the summit of its ascent it seemed to hover for a beat and then returned into his hand at leisure, defying the claim of gravity. As it descended it brought the faintest drizzle down with it, cooling their upturned faces. Monday cooed with pleasure.
"Rain out of nowhere," he said. "I remember that."
Gentle left him bathing the grime from his face and went to join Chica Jackeen, who had finished explaining his intentions to his colleagues. They all hung back, watching the maestros with uneasy stares.
"They think we're going to die," Chica Jackeen explained.
"They may very well be right," Gentle said quietly. "Are you certain you want to come with me?"
"I was never more certain of anything."
With that they started towards the ambiguous ground that lay between the solidity of the second and the erasure's vacancy. As they went, one of Jackeen's friends began to call after him, in distress at his departure. The cry was taken up by several others, their shouts too mingled to be interpreted. Jackeen halted for a moment and glanced back towards the company he was leaving. Gentle made no attempt to urge him on. He ignored the shouts and picked up his speed, the erasure thickening around him and the smell of the devastation that lay on the other side growing stronger with every step he took. He was prepared for it, however. Instead of holding his breath, he drew the stench of his father's rot deep into his lungs, defying its pungency. There was another shout from behind him, but this time it wasn't one of Jackeen's friends, it was the maestro himself, his voice coloured more by wonder than alarm. Its tone piqued Gentle's curiosity, and he glanced back over his shoulder to seek Jackeen out, but the nullity had come between them. Unwilling to be delayed, Gentle forged on, a purpose in his stride he didn't comprehend,
His enfeebled legs had found strength from somewhere. His heart was urgent in his chest. Ahead, the blinding murk was stirring, the first vague forms of the firsts to rain emerging. And from behind, Jackeen again.
"Maestro! Maestro, where are you?"
Without slowing his stride, Gentle returned the call.
"Here!"
"Wait for me?"
Jackeen gasped.
"Wait!"
He emerged from the void to lay his hand on Gentle's shoulder.
"What is it?"
Gentle said, looking around at Jackeen, who, as if in bliss, had dropped the toll of years and was once again a young man, sweaty with awe at the way of fates.
"The waters,"
he said.
"What about them?"
"They followed you, Maestro. They followed you."
And as he spoke, they came. Oh, how they came. They ran to Gentle's feet in glittering rills that broke against his ankles and his shins and leapt like silver snakes towards his hands, or rather, towards the stone he held in his hands. And seeing their elation and their zeal, he heard Huzar's laughter and felt again her tiny fingers brushing his arm as she passed the blue egg on to him. He didn't doubt for a moment that she'd known what would come of the gift. So, most likely, had Jude. He'd become their agent at the last, just as he'd become his mother's, and the thought of that sweet service brought an echo of the child's laughter to his lips. From above, the egg was calling down a drizzle to swell the waters swirling underfoot, and in the space of seconds, the patter became a roar, and a deluge descended, violent enough to sluice the murk of the erasure out of the air. After a few moments, light began to break around the maestros, the first light this terrain had seen since Hypexamendios had drawn the void over his dominion. By it, Gentle saw that Jackeen's exhilaration was rapidly turning to panic.
"We're going to drown!" he yelled, fighting to stay on his feet as the water deepened.
Gentle didn't retreat. He knew where his duty lay. As the surf broke against their backs, the tide threatening to drag them under, he raised Huzar's gift to his lips and kissed it, just as she had done. Then he mustered all his strength and threw the stone out over the landscape that was being uncovered before them. The egg went from his hand with a momentum that was not his sinew's work but its own ambition, and instantly the waters went in pursuit of it, dividing around the maestros and taking their tides off into the wasteland of the first. It would take the waters weeks, perhaps even months, to cover the dominion from end to end, and most of that work would go unwitnessed. But in the next few hours, standing at their vantage point where the City of God had once begun, the maestros were granted a glimpse of their labour. The clouds above the first, which had been as inert as the landscape beneath, now began to churn and roil and shed their anguish in stupendous storms, which in turn swelled the rivers that were driving their cleansing way across the rot. Hypexamendios's remains were not despised. With the purpose of the goddesses fueling their every drop, the waters turned the slaughterhouse over and over and over, scouring the matter of its poisons and sweeping it up into mounds, which the exhilarated air festooned with vapours. The first ground that appeared from this tumult was close to the feet of the maestros and rapidly became a ragged peninsula that stretched fully a mile into the dominion. The waters broke against it constantly, bringing with every wave another freight of Hypexamendios's clay to increase its flanks. Gentle was patient for a time and stayed at the border. But he could not resist the invitation forever, and finally, ignoring Jackeen's words of caution, he set off down the spine of land to better see the spectacle visible from the far end. The waters were still draining from the new earth, and here and there lightning still ran on the slopes, but the ground was solid enough, and there were seedlings everywhere, carried, he presumed, from his Isordarex. If so, there would be abundant life here in a little while. By the time he'd reached the end of the peninsula, the clouds overhead were beginning to clear somewhat, lighter for their furies. Farther off, of course, the process he'd been privileged to witness was just beginning, as the storms spread in all directions from their point of origin. By their blazes, he glimpsed the snaking rivers, going about their work with undiminished ambition. Here on the promontory, however, there was a more benign light. The first dominion had a sun, it seemed, and though it wasn't yet warm, Gentle didn't wait for balmier weather to begin his last labours, but took his album and his pen from his jacket, and sat down on the marshy headland to work. He still had the map of the desert between the gates of Isordrex and the Erasure to set down, and though these pages would doubtless be the barest in the album, they had to be drawn all the more carefully for that fact. He wanted their very spareness to have a beauty of its own. After perhaps an hour of concentrated work, he heard Jacqueline behind him, first a footfall, then a question.
"Speaking in tongues, maestro?"
Gentle hadn't even been aware of the inventory he was rattling off until his attention was drawn to it, a seamless list of names that must have been incomprehensible to anyone other than himself, the stopping places of his pilgrimage, as familiar to his tongue as his many names.
"Are you sketching the new world?"
Jacqueline asked him, hesitating to come too close to the artist while he worked.
"No, no," said Gentle. "I'm finishing a map."
He paused, then corrected himself.
"No, not finishing. Starting."
"May I look?"
"If you like."
Jacqueline went down on his haunches behind Gentle and peered over his shoulder. The pages that depicted the desert were as complete as Gentle could make them. He was now attempting to delineate the peninsula he was sitting on, and something of the scene in front of him. It would be little more than a line or two, but it was a beginning.
"I wonder, would you fetch Monday for me?"
"Is there something you need?"
"Yes. I want him to take these maps back into the Fifth with him, and give them to Clem."
"Who's Clem?"
"An angel."
"Ah."
"Would you bring him here?"
"Now?"
"If you would," Gentle said. "I'm almost done."
Ever dutiful, Jacqueline stood up and started back towards the second, leaving Gentle to work on. There was very little left to do. He finished making his crude rendering of the promontory, then he added a line of dots along it to mark his path, and at the headland placed a small cross at the spot where he was sitting. That done, he went back through the album to be certain that the pages were in proper order. It occurred to him, as he did so, that he'd fashioned a self-portrait. Like its maker, the map was flawed, but, he hoped, redeemable. A rudimentary thing that might see finer versions in the fullness of time, be made and remade and made again. Perhaps forever. He was about to set the album down beside the pen when he heard a hint of coherence in the surf that was beating against the slope below. Unable to quite make sense of the sound, he ventured to the edge. The ground was too newly made to be solid and threatened to crumble away beneath his weight, but he peered over as far as he could, and what he saw and what he heard were enough to make him retreat from the edge, kneel down in the dirt, and with trembling hands, start scribbling a message to accompany the maps. It was necessarily brief. He could hear the words clearly now, rising from the surge of waves. They distracted him with promises.
"Nisi Nirvana," they said. "Nisi Nirvana."
By the time he'd finished his note, laid down the album and the pen beside it, and returned to the edge of the promontory, the sun of this dominion was emerging from the storm clouds overhead to shed its light on the waves below. The beams placated them for a time, soothing their frenzy and piercing them so that Gentle had a glimpse of the ground they were moving over. It was not, it seemed, an earth at all, but another sky, and in it was a sphere so majestic that to his eyes all the bodies in the heavens of the Imagica, all stars, all moons, all noonday suns, could not in their sum have touched its glory. Here was the door that his father's city had been built to seal, the door through which his mother's name in fable had been whispered. It had been closed for millenniums, but now it stood open, and through it a music of voices was rising, going on its way to every wandering spirit in Imagica and calling them home to rapture. In its midst was a voice Gentle knew, and before he'd even glimpsed its source, his mind had shaped the face that called him, and his body felt the arms that would wrap him around and bear him up. Then they were there, those arms, that face, rising from the door to claim him, and he needed to imagine them no longer.
Are you finished? He was asked.
Yes, he replied. I'm finished.
Good, said Pai Opa, smiling. Then we can begin.
The congregation Chikajekian had left at the perimeter of the first had steadily begun to venture along the peninsula as their courage and curiosity grew. Monday was, of course, among them, and Jackeen was just about to call the boy and summon him to the reconciler's side when Monday let out a cry of his own, pointing back along the promontory. Jackeen turned and fixed his eyes, as did they all, on the two figures standing on the headland embracing. Later there would be much discussion between these witnesses as to what they'd actually seen. All agreed that one of the pair was the Maestro Sartori. As to the other, opinions differed widely. Some said they saw a woman, others a man, still others a cloud with a piece of sun burning in it. But whatever these ambiguities, what followed was not in doubt. Having embraced, the two figures advanced to the limit of the promontory, where they stepped out into the air and were gone. 2 weeks later, on the penultimate day of a cheerless December, Clem was sitting in front of the fire in the dining room of number 28, a spot from which he'd seldom risen since Christmas, when he heard a hectic beating on the front door. He was not wearing a watch, what did time matter now, but he assumed it was long after midnight. Anyone calling at such an hour was likely to be either desperate or dangerous, but in his present bleak mood he scarcely cared what harm might await him in the street outside. There was nothing left for him here, in this house, in this life. Gentle had gone, Judy had gone, and so, most recently, had Tay. It was 5 days since he'd heard his lover whisper his name.
Clem, I have to go.
Go,
he'd replied. Where to?
Somebody opened the door, came Tay's reply.
The dead are being called home. I have to go.
They wept together for a while, tears pouring down Clem's eyes while the sound of Tay's anguish racked him from within, but there was no help for it. The call had come, and though Tay was grief-stricken at the thought of parting from Clem, his existence between conditions had become unbearable, and beneath the sorrow of parting was the joyful knowledge of imminent release. Their strange union was over. It was time for the living and the dead to part. Clem hadn't known what loss really was until Tay left. The pain of losing his lover's physical body had been acute enough, but losing the spirit that had so miraculously returned to him was immeasurably worse. It was not possible, he thought, to be emptier than this and still be a living being. Several times during those dark days he'd wondered if he should simply kill himself and hope he would be able to follow his lover through whatever door now stood open. That he didn't was more a consequence of the responsibility he felt than from lack of courage. He was the only witness to the miracles of Gamut Street left in this dominion. If he departed, who would there be to tell the tale? But such imperatives seemed frail things at an hour like this, and as he rose from the fire and crossed to the front door, he allowed himself the thought that if these midnight callers came with death in their hands, perhaps he would not refuse it. Without asking who was on the other side, he slid back the bolts and opened the door. To his surprise, he discovered Monday standing in the driving sleet. Beside him stood a shivering stranger, his thinning curls flattened to his skull.
"This is Chikajekian," Monday said, as he hauled his sodden guest over the threshold. "Jackie, this is Clem, 8th wonder of the world. Well, am I too wet to get a hug?"
Clem opened his arms to Monday, who embraced him with fervour. "I thought you and Gentle had gone forever," Clem said.
"Well, one of us has," came the reply.
"I guessed as much," Clem said. "Tay went after him. And the Revenants, too.
When was this?"
"Christmas Day."
Jackeen's teeth were chattering, and Clem ushered him through to the fire, which he had been fueling with sticks of furniture. He threw on a couple of chair legs and invited Jackeen to sit by the blaze to thaw out. The man thanked him and did so. Monday, however, was made of sterner stuff. Availing himself of the whiskey that sat beside the hearth, he put several mouthfuls into his system. then set about clearing the room, explaining as he dragged the table into the corner that they needed some working space. With the floor cleared, he opened his jacket and pulled Gentle's gazetteer from beneath his arm, dropping it in front of Clem.
"What's this?" "It's a map of the Imagica," Monday said. "Gentle's work?"
"Yep." Monday went down on his haunches and flipped the album open, taking out the loose leaves and handing the cover back up to Clem.
"He wrote a message in it," Monday said.
While Clem read the few words Gentle had scribbled on the cover, Monday began to arrange the sheets side by side on the floor, carefully aligning them so that the maps became an unbroken flow. As he worked, he talked, his enthusiasm as unalloyed as ever.
"You know what he wants us to do, don't you? He wants us to draw this map on every fucking wall we can find. On the pavements, on our foreheads, anywhere and everywhere."
"That's quite a task," said Clem.
"I'm here to help you," Chickajackian said, "in whatever capacity I can."
He got up from the fire and came to stand beside Clem, where he could admire the pattern that was emerging on the floor in front of them.
"That's not the only thing you've come to do, is it?" Monday said. "Be honest."
"Well, no," said Jackie. "I'd also like to find myself a wife. But that will have to wait."
"Damn right," said Monday. "This is our business now."
He stood up and stepped out of the circle which the pages of Gentle's album had formed. Here was the Imagica, or rather the tiny part of it which the Reconciler had seen. Padashokwa and Vanayef, Beatrix and the mountains of the Jokalela, Maike, the Cradle, Limbi and the Quem, the Lenten Way, the Delta, and Isordarex. And then the crossroads outside the city, and the desert beyond, with a single track leading to the borders of the Second Dominion. On the other side of that border, the pages were practically empty. The Wanderer had sketched the peninsula he'd sat on, but beyond it he'd simply written, "This is a new world."
"And this," said Jackeen, stooping to indicate the cross at the end of the promontory, "is where the Maestro's pilgrimage ended."
"Is that where he's buried?" Clem said.
"Oh, no,"
Jackeen said.
"He's gone to places that'll make this life seem like a dream. He's left the circle, you see."
"No, I don't," said Clem. "If he's left the circle, then where's he gone? Where have they all gone?"
"Into it," Jackeen said.
Clem began to smile.
"May I?"
said Jackeen, rising and claiming from Clem's fingers the sheet which carried Gentle's last message.
"My friends," he'd written, "Pi is here. I am found. Will you show these pages to the world so that every wanderer may find their way home?"
"I think our duty is plain, gentlemen," Jackeen said.
He stooped again to lay the final page in the middle of the circle, marking the place of spirits to which the Reconciler had gone.
"And when we've done that duty, we have here the map that will show us where we must go. We'll follow him. There's nothing more certain. We'll all of us follow him by and by."
This has been Imagica, written by Clive Barker, narrated by Simon Vance. Copyright 1991-2009 by Clive Barker, Inc. Production copyright 2015 by David N. Wilson and Crossroad Press.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.